Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
If you've spent any time on a job website, you may have noticed that one word crops up a lot: creative. Companies and the people who run them profess to love employees who will generate new ideas. So why do they so often reject those ideas in favor of the status quo? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest has discovered a surprisingly common unconscious bias against creativity, even among those who profess to value it. And the more responsibility we have as decision makers, the more walls we may unwittingly build to keep new ideas at bay. So how can we recognize our own biases against what is new and different? And how can we best sell our ideas to the people in charge? Social psychologist Jennifer Mueller is associate professor of management at the University of San Diego. Her new book is called Creative Change: Why We Resist It, How We Can Embrace It. Jennifer, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. I'm so thrilled to be here, in no small part because I grew up listening to you. I got my degree at SMU. So I'm an SMU alum, go Ponies. And so this is just a thrill for me to
be
here.
Welcome home in a figurative sense, since you were there in San Diego.
Correct.
So, many people consider creativity to belong to the arts, but you're looking at its utility in business, in science, in education, lots of other fields.
That's right. I think that if you ask educators, what does creativity mean? Interestingly, what they'll say is dance. They'll say collages. They'll say doing artistic work. When in fact, any discipline that you can imagine, we all know what creativity means in physics. We all know what creativity means in mathematics. And it means changing the paradigm. It means going from one way of defining something to a second way, which may even seem opposite or contrary to the first. So that's absolutely right. Creativity is a broader definition than I think many people believe.
So help us understand this. When we say we want creative ideas, it's not that we're lying exactly, but we may resist them without realizing it.
That's right. I think when you look at people generating ideas, for example, if I'm in a classroom, and I have people generating ideas, they express joy. You'll see them laughing, surprise. And then when you say, all right, you need to put your money where your mouth is and now decide which idea to go for and say, look, you need to find the best idea, that positive energy ends and something else happens. People become a little bit more concerned. They'll say things like, well, I want to make the best decision. I want to make the decision that's correct. What's feasible? What will solve the problem I have? What's profitable? And what they mean when they say that is that the uncertainty around these new ideas is something that's not okay anymore. It's okay in the context of generating these ideas because you're not focusing on the outcome as much. You're focusing on trying to find something different than what has been used before. But when people get into this mindset of wanting to know the best decision, all of a sudden, that tolerance for uncertainty, the very essence of creativity, goes away. And we find that when people are in that mindset, which I called in the book the how best mindset, in the laboratory, we place people in this mindset. These are undergraduates. And we say there's one best solution, write an essay supporting that statement versus there's many possible solutions. And we find that when they're in that statement trying to support this notion, there's one best solution, they associate words like creative with words like vomit, even when saying that creativity is great and they love it and they want more of it. In other words, explicitly, people say they love creativity, but when they see creative ideas that have uncertain feasibility, uncertain value, they go to vomit. They go to ick, as opposed to, aha, that's interesting. And what's amazing is, if you look at just the general population, you don't see that. In the general population, if they're not in this how best mindset, the average person, the consumer, the student will associate creativity with words like peace, love, and heaven. Hmm. So it's something that people really do love, just not when they're in this mindset.
It's really interesting because certainly some creative ideas are not feasible, but that doesn't it doesn't necessarily mean that a new idea isn't just as practical as what we've been doing all along.
Well, I think another way to say it is we don't know how feasible they are. So there's this example of the Post-it, which I might bring up again, because it's a wonderful example and illustrates some of the myths we have about creativity. We talk about the creation myth, how Art Brief came up with this Post-it. But what he did to make it feasible was he went through, so our Art Brief was an employee of 3M in the 70s. And he, in order to make the Post-it a reality, had to kind of go to different departments, go to different engineers, and he basically cobbled together a machine and put it in his basement to make Post-its. And in fact, he made it feasible. Initially, yes, it wasn't feasible on the outset, but the point was that the resources in 3M did in fact exist to make it feasible. It just required even more creativity to do just that.
So you performed experiments, you discovered this bias, and then when you first demonstrated your findings to colleagues, they rejected the idea that an implicit bias against creativity existed. I mean, did that just prove your point?
Well, you know, so this the story in the way I felt it, because, you know, this is what happens when you generate a creative idea. You really feel it. And, you know, so we generated this idea and I wanted to present it to colleagues. And I did what all the experts said to do about how to pitch a new idea. Prepare. I was prepared. I had slides prepared for the questions I thought they would ask, the questions that they did ask. I knew the data backwards and forwards. And when I sat in front of the audience, what emerged was stink eye. Have you ever seen stink eye emerge from a group of people? And I'm thinking, is there something on my face? Is there, what is going on? And person after person in the audience said, this won't be published. We don't like the methods. We already know people resist change. This isn't interesting. And I will always recall the pity and compassion on the faces of the doctoral students staring at me as I gave this presentation. And, you know, when I felt so discouraged because I thought, you know what, I really thought I had something. And I called my colleagues and I said, what am I going to do? And they said, Jen, no, maybe it's not just preparation. Maybe it's an analogy. Maybe you kind of got to place people and give them a comparison that's kind of far enough away from the creativity literature, but close enough so they can see the value in the analogy we had in the paper we initially submitted was, you know, just as people can have these explicit positive regard for a given social group. And in addition to that, also an implicit, that is knee-jerk reaction, negative feeling towards the same social group. People can feel the same way about creativity. That is, they can say they love it, but their knee-jerk reaction is negative, and it may be that they're unaware of it. And when we included that analogy on paragraph 2 in the paper, I don't know if it was that analogy or what, the paper was published almost immediately and had 50,000 downloads within 2 months, which for an academic paper, this was had statistics. You know, it was written like by pocket protectors like me. You know, it wasn't written with stories and, in, you know, engaging material. And so 500 would have been a home run. 50,000 was a movement. People really, it resonated with them that there's something happening, that decision makers and everyone's floundering confusion when trying to evaluate these ideas. And I realized there's a real opportunity to help people overcome this and to learn this new skill about how to recognize creative ideas.
Why are we so reluctant to acknowledge that creative ideas might cause us to seize up and feel some negativity?
You know, it's a complicated question, and I don't have all the answers. I do know that in the U.S., we have this individualistic culture. I recently ran a study with Ella Maron Spector over in the Technion University, where we asked Israelis to generate new ideas and practical ideas. And it turned out that when they generated new ideas, they felt this emotional attachment to these ideas that reflected their individuality. And I think that's true in America, too, that it makes us feel distinctive and unique. And it makes us feel proud of ourselves because that's part of, you know, the discussion in Texas, right? Texas, they're independent, you know, being independent and thinking the way you think and saying what you mean. Like, these are things that I think Texans really resonate towards. And that's what creativity is all about. So I think it's partially this American value that we have, that being creative is important, when the reality is that when you want to have an answer now that's correct, creativity becomes very complicated, very difficult, and can lead you to fail. And that's not something somebody who wants a correct and accurate decision can tolerate.
Are we somehow wired to favor the status quo over what's new and different?
For sure. And in fact, my colleague Scott Edelman over at the University of Arkansas and I had tried to do a series of experiments to try to overcome the status quo bias. So there's this bias that exists, and what it is anything that has existed before or for a long time, or many people use it. that people prefer these kinds of options. So an example of a study would be, you know, acupuncture is either 200 years old or 2000. You know, which do you prefer? And people tend to prefer acupuncture when it's 2000, described as 2000 years old relative to 200. So something being around for a long time, people like it. And part of the reason is they think survival of the fittest. And this is the Achilles heel of any creative idea. It doesn't have a lot of people using it yet. It hasn't existed before, or if it has, it probably hasn't existed for a long time. And when you emphasize this, and when people are made aware of this in the course of pitching an idea, you can actually shoot yourself in the foot and make people say, well, nobody's using this. Why should I use it? Survival of the fittest, right? So it's something to be aware of, that creative ideas don't have properties that status quo ideas have. And it can trick people into thinking the status quo ideas are even better, even when times have changed and the status quo idea won't work anymore.
It makes me think about the fact, and this is not a commentary on any kind of religious belief system, but we tend to be most comfortable with things that people have been believing for a long time. When a new system of beliefs come along, we're much more likely to label that a cult. It may or may not be, but we just are made very uncomfortable by that.
I think that's true. I think another way to think about it is that, you know, if you're in this how best mindset, I believe the how best mindset is I'm starting to understand that this is how we live our lives. You know, Chris, if you want to go tonight to dinner and a movie, you might decide to look up on Yelp to find the best restaurant, to look up on Rotten Tomatoes to find the best movie. You know, when you're trying to figure out how to get to work, you're going to find the best path. So there's many ways in which this how best way of thinking is really efficient. And it's stuff that we know before, that's been vetted. When we need a new idea, when those solutions can't solve our problem, do you know what I'm saying? When the solutions that's in that set just can't solve our problem, then all of a sudden we're stuck, because the how best mindset keeps us in this bubble. It keeps us looking for the solutions, the discovered territory people already know. And I suppose cults may give you this sense that the best solutions are in this bubble. Outside of this bubble, bad. Inside the bubble, good. And so we're starting to see how difficult it is to get out of our own bubbles. Listening is not enough, because if you're in a cult and you define the world in a certain way, and that's what you believe, even when you see evidence to the contrary, you're not going to believe it, and you're going to focus more on the evidence that confirms your theory and disregard the evidence that disconfirms it. So what I stumbled upon is, in addition to, you know, creativity, how difficult it is to get out of our own bubbles, how difficult it is to see value in the new when we have things like strategic direction and the feasibility of our companies and religious institutions that believe there's a right way to do something, when in fact there's solutions that are congruent with our values, but we can't see their value because our definitions are getting in the way.
The bias against creativity can start early. You discover that many teachers are inclined to discourage creativity in their students. I can't imagine any teacher sets out to do this.
No, they don't. In fact, when you ask teachers in the UK and in the US, they'll say creativity is so important. But remember, they define creativity as the arts, as collages, as the stuff you might add on to a project as sort of a secondary concern. And they don't necessarily think about creativity in this broader way. And, so this has been research that's been done. And furthermore, you know, students that are creative are labeled as disruptive. And I think it creates all kinds of other secondary problems, because we're finding millennials, we're starting to see that they're not feeling as comfortable with creative ideas as we might hope, given the future where we need these creative solutions.
My guest is social psychologist Jennifer Mueller, associate professor of management at the University of San Diego and author of Creative Change: Why We Resist It, How We Can Embrace It. You can join us now at 1-800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program for working adults, like Dr. Jeffrey Funk, exploring medical education for a new generation of medical professionals. More at smu.edu/DLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with social psychologist Jennifer Mueller of the University of San Diego. Her new book is called Creative Change: Why We Resist It, How We Can Embrace It. Join us by emailing think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. Jennifer, how does our openness to executing creative solutions or accepting them change as we take on greater responsibilities at work?
Yes. So recently, some colleagues of mine and I, Shamil Melwani, Jeff Lowenstein, and Jennifer Deal, we conducted a study where we put people in a decision-making role or a control condition. The decision-making role had decision-making responsibility to invite a startup to campus. And the control condition was just somebody told to evaluate this new startup. And what we found was when a person was in a decision-making role where they were allocating scarce resources, they adopted this how best mindset. And when they saw a creative idea and that idea had a poor metric, like poor Facebook likes, not many Kickstarter investors, they thought that idea wasn't very creative. And if that same idea had a lot of metrics, they thought the idea was very creative. But what was interesting is the average student didn't see a difference in creativity in the same company that had poor or terrific metrics. They saw them as both creative. And what that means is we used to believe there's this kind of a dilemma that decision makers face, that they know that creative solutions don't have great metrics, and they have pressure by their organizations to choose ideas with great metrics. But sometimes, because they understand that there's this dilemma, they can choose to take the path, the riskier path of the creative idea that don't have great, that do not yet have great metrics. But what we found was there is no dilemma. That when people are in a decision-making role, what they label as creative is the idea that has mass market, great metrics, lots of people use it, lots of people like it, and that's just not necessarily A, how creative ideas look, and B, metrics are actually hugely noisy indicators of a value of an idea. They can be faked. They can simply reflect that lots of people are following the herd. You can buy them from India, you know, Furthermore, when you see investors following other investors when they're deciding to make investment decisions, so in other words, when they're trying to invest in new products and they see a lot of other investors investing and they decide to invest, they tend to overvalue the investment, pay more money, and abandon their decision later. So just because a lot of people are doing something doesn't, when something is new, doesn't mean it's actually any good. And this is why Eric Ries in his Lean Startup book talks about vanity metrics. But what we're showing is that the vanity metrics actually make decision makers think something's really innovative and creative. Hmm. And there's a disconnect between how they're thinking and the consumers that they're hoping to serve.
A few months ago, we did a whole hour on this show about the downfall of Research in Motion, the company that made Blackberries. And not least among their problems was failing to recognize that the iPhone was, in fact, going to be a big deal.
Yes, that's right. In fact, I tried to get into RIM and work with their decision makers early on, right before the fall. And their discussion with me was, look, we're doing so well. We don't have time to talk to you about how we make decisions about creative ideas. And I think one of the things that's interesting about their situation was that they saw this trend, but their sales were going up and up and up and up and up. And from those metrics were telling them, your idea is creative and great, even as they saw this other trend emerging. So it can make it very, when people are in these decision-making roles, I think the problem, Chris, is what I'm discovering is there's a new skill set. It's not enough to just vet ideas in terms of risk, in terms of quality. And the reason why when ideas are new is because new ideas have this unknowability about them. Risk assessments don't work. They're not even relevant. They're almost, I would argue, ROI, a waste of time potentially. And what makes it even more complicated is ROI and these risk assessments make a lot of sense for ideas that are more familiar, that we have a lot of experience with. So creative ideas, I'm learning, are just different kinds of animals that need to be treated differently. And it's a different new leadership skill set to manage them. And I think where you can see this really starkly is a 2010 study conducted by IBM. And they asked 1,500 C-suite executives, what skill do you need to lead in future? And these 1,500 executives in the C-suite said, creativity. Hmm. But they defined creativity as being able to disrupt their mindset, being able to tolerate uncertainty, being able to see new directions maybe the organization isn't going in. Basically, they define creativity as making change with creativity. And even more striking is over 50% of the executives sampled said that while creativity was the key skill of the new era, they did not feel trained or comfortable to lead with creativity. They didn't know how. They didn't have the skills. So I thought I wanted to write a book that began that conversation of how do we help decision makers in every field, in medicine, in my field, in management, in corporations, in politics, how do in education, how do we help them make these decisions to see value in the new as opposed to these old strategies which are basically causing them to associate creativity with vomit, even though they may not be aware of it.
How can decision makers tell the difference between inherent bias that may be causing them to pass up an idea that is good but untested and an instinct to reject an idea because it's maybe legitimately a bad idea?
That's a great question. So what we know so far is when we see these rejections, what we see is people make them very quickly. It's the speed at which they make them. So the knee-jerk reaction, oh, this is terrible. What we see is better decision-making happening when people have discussions not only about how bad the idea is and how it's not feasible and how we don't have the money and we don't have the resources in-house and nobody will buy this and it's not profitable and the metrics look bad, but also people interjecting the conversation to say, wait a minute, hold on. What value, what broader value, what problem is this idea solving? What's the broader goal that we're trying to achieve? Let's use an analogy to a different field to kind of get a sense of whether or not this idea really makes sense. And it's that kind of a balance. So it's not just these how best concerns. It's also these concerns that are broader. I call them, you know, for lack of a better term, why potential. These questions about why, the potential the idea has, the broader purpose and value of the idea. It's when teams are able to do both and not just one. And balance both and cycle back and forth as opposed to just focusing on one for 5 minutes and then focusing on the other for 5 minutes. It's literally like a dialectic. It's back forth. And that's when we see decision making where it gives room for novelty. The ideas are vetted well and we don't see these knee-jerk negative reactions, which tend to harm a company's ability to see value in new opportunities that can take them in the direction that they really, really want to go.
What can you tell us about how consumers respond to creative products and innovative services? How much familiarity do the people who might buy this stuff have to have before they're willing to risk something as small as the purchase price of whatever the item is?
Such a great question. Well, purchase price is a big deal, of course. Well, Jeff Lowenstein and I recently published a study, and we looked at American consumers, and we asked them, what is it? When you see creativity, what is it? What are these features you associate with creativity? And we were really open-ended because we wanted to know, do people not like creativity? Are they going to say negative things? Are they going to say only positive things? And what we found was kind of fascinating. It turns out 70% of American consumers, when they say, ooh, that's creative, and that matters, Chris, because when people say something's creative, they're more likely to buy it. They're more likely to spread the word about it because creative ideas give you, to quote Jonah Berger at Wharton's research, social currency. You look cool and if you're the one who's spreading the idea. So what are these features? Well, we found that an idea that was surprising, idea that made people happy, idea that was seen as a breakthrough, a paradigm shift, a repurposing of something, a combination of two things that might seem opposite, that these were considered to be markers for 70% of Americans of creativity. And what was not seen to be a marker of creativity was whether or not the product was fashionable for a mass market, very socially accepted by lots of people. That was seen to harm that feeling of fit with creativity. People were like, ah, that's not so. If everybody's using it, that's not creative. But what was interesting was 30% of consumers felt the same way that the 70% did about all the markers around novelty, right? It's surprising. It's a repurposing. But they felt that the idea also need it to be mass market and feasible, and lots of people are using it, and fashionable and socially accepted. For them, they needed that other piece, the scale of people using the idea to help them feel that an idea was creative. So there are two definitions of creativity out there that we found. 70% really just focus on the new stuff and the feeling that they have when they see the idea. And 30% focus on that stuff, but they also want to see lots of people are using it. It has mass scale and mass impact. And interestingly, that second way, the 30% of US, they look like, more like the decision makers and organizations. And we have some evidence they also look more like the Chinese and how the Chinese kind of view creativity too. So that's where we are now in learning what people view as indicating creativity.
We have an email here from Don in Dallas who says, for your current thinking about fostering creativity, to what degree do you see that encouraging a growth mindset at either the individual or team level can help to encourage creativity in an organization?
Right. Well, there's encourage creativity in the sense of generating ideas. And by the way, Don, this is a great question because Carol Dweck came up with this wonderful paradigm of research looking at fixed versus growth mindset. So she applies this to how people see their own performance. Do you have a fixed performance that is you're smart or you're dumb and that's not going to change? Or do you have a growth mindset when you evaluate your performance, meaning I tried hard or I didn't try hard enough? And so in the context of creativity, these mindsets also matter. And growth mindsets, you know, in general, if you apply it to an idea, kind of make a lot of sense. You know, ideas do change and they morph over time, and that's great. But what I found in my own work is that when it comes to vetting ideas, this other piece, these fixed qualities of ideas, the metrics, they also matter. So, you know, in when it comes to creativity, just focusing on the growth, I think kind of leaves decision makers kind of feeling a little bit skeptical. They're like, wait a minute, we have to make money. We have to actually show results. So this, again, getting back to this balance between the two, you need both. One, just having a growth mindset might not allow you to be able to say, you know what, sunk costs, we can't continue on in this direction. We're losing too much money. We can't keep on banking on the possibility it's going to grow and grow and grow. There has to be a point at which we just realize it's not the direction for us. And a growth mindset is not exactly very adept at that, is it? That's not its strength. But this other way of thinking, this fixed mindset, is more so. So I don't know that the how best mindset and the fixed mindset are the same necessarily, because we're talking about ideas and not people. But the way I think of it is you really do need to cultivate both sides, or you can veer off and fall in love with ideas even as they're starting to bankrupt your company. Or, you know, you can reject ideas out of hand, which are really valuable. That second theme is what I see more happening now in organizations than the former.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is social psychologist Jennifer Mueller of the University of San Diego, author of Creative Change, Why We Resist It, How We Can Embrace It. Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak now with Shannon in Arlington. Hi, Shannon.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. I'm sorry.
Not taking your job, don't worry.
Yeah, sorry about that. No, I'm a little bit nervous. Anyway, I am one of those victims of this creativity.
Oh.
Yes, I was working on my master in English literature. I passed 27 hours. 9 hours before graduation, I was kicked out of the program merely because I felt free to express my own opinion, which two of my professors did not like it completely. In my background, I have to tell you, I'm a Muslim, so I had to make them understand that I was a liberated Muslim, so they don't get nervous about my religious background. But anyway, on the program, graduate program, you cannot come with C. Before that, my average was 3.5, and then two of the teachers, by the way, they published books jointly together, got together and they gave me a C and kicked me out of the program. So, and they did not accept my proposal. And even though I'm a Muslim, I'm not a conservative, very conservative person. I grew up reading Jean-Paul Sartre, Kafka, Camus, and, you know, authors like this. My mistake was I told one of the teachers that philosophy was subjective.
Well, Shannon, I'm so sorry that you had those experiences, and I do appreciate your call. Jennifer, maybe you can talk a little bit about rebounding. If we've had a great, what we think was a great creative idea, and for whatever reason, someone has disagreed with us, and then we're stymied at the company, at the university, at the institution we were at.
I think, you know, I'm so sorry to hear this, and I hear this so much. And I think part of this, though, is how education is structured. So Tom Fogarty, who I interviewed for the book, Thomas Fogarty, who is a physician who came up with the balloon catheter, who basically saved 20 million lives. And he, when he talks about schooling, first off, this is a person who was kicked or failed much of his schooling, almost didn't make it into medical school, had a very, very difficult time. And when he talks about teachers, he talks about teachers don't want to encourage you to learn. They want you to spout back to them what they think. That literally to get an A in a class means you have a correct, right answer. And the answer is whatever it is that they think and how they frame the problem. Now this isn't anything against teachers, because from a teaching perspective, you want to give fair grades. And one way to do that is to be able to diminish ambiguity. If there's a correct answer, you want to be able to fairly say this person gets this grade or this grade. So it's very complicated for a teacher to evaluate something that's really new and outside their expertise, or challenging their fundamental expertise. And so what happens is, it's not that your idea isn't great. It's that the way your idea is making them feel is horrible. And you have to disentangle those two things, because they're really important. Once you understand that when you have a creative idea, it can, and it challenges experts, it can make that expert feel, they either go through an identity crisis and realize they're not expert, you know?
Yeah.
And so another thing, when you have a person in that kind of a how best mindset, they're not going to want to hear your creative idea. So learning how to pitch it to them, learning the other tools you can use to pitch it sideways, is a better way to go than going directly and pitching it directly towards them like you would any other more familiar idea.
And we're going to talk about how to do those pitches right after this break. My guest is Jennifer Mueller. Her new book is Creative Change: Why We Resist It, How We Can Embrace It. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/DLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with University of San Diego social psychologist Jennifer Mueller. Her new book is called Creative Change: Why We Resist It, How We Can Embrace It. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org, or you can find us on Twitter @KERAThink. So Jennifer, early in the hour, you told us that you used an analogy to help people understand the bias against creativity, in that it may relate to the kind of implicit racial bias that can exist even among people who have explicit beliefs that seem to contradict that. Some other strategies are what you call aha strategies. Can you explain those?
Yes. So the previous caller really moved me, and part of what moved me so much is the reality that, you know, we don't, when we have our own creative ideas, for us they make sense. They're music in our mind. We could hear, we can understand them. And when you're talking to somebody else who hasn't had that aha, you know, who hasn't yet made the connections, our creative ideas we can hear in our mind sound to them like a cacophony, like it just too many notes, you know? And so part of what an aha strategy is a reverse engineering of a creative process. So that very process you went through, to have that aha and you went, oh, wow, that's so cool. And right, you had all these positive reactions and it felt so good and it felt surprising. In some ways, to reverse engineer that in your listener so that they have the same experience. So one of the mechanisms that people are using to generate ideas now in this new form of research is analogical thinking. So using analogies in order to help people come up with new ideas. So and people have talked about analogies before, but analogies can be tricky because you don't want to compare something to something else that's too similar. So for example, there's this wonderful example of this United Artists executive rejecting Star Wars. And one of the reasons why is the executive makes an analogy from Star Wars to 2001, A Space Odyssey. That's the analogy that's made. And he says, look, you know, the analogy is, it makes sense that this executive would have done that. 2001 was very financially successful. But the problem is that, you know, of course, 2001 is all about psychological angst. And Star Wars is a Western, you know, so a better analogy would have been a Western, because a Western has some, it's different enough so that people aren't saying, hey, look, you're not doing the thing, you're not matching what you should be matching. And it's similar enough so that you could see that there's some structural similarities. So it keeps people from using this, is it correct or is it not, way of thinking, which is what they use when they have a comparison or an analogy from something that's very similar in a similar category. So the previous caller, when he's talking about a philosophy, a philosophical idea and subjectivity, one thing you could do, and of course, I don't know anything about philosophy, so I can't speak of this intelligently, but perhaps look at a different domain of study and look at a prominent figure and see if there's a way to make an analogy between that different domain of study, not too similar, but different enough to the idea that you have. And that way, it turns it into something that people, it gives them the right comparison to make and can reverse engineer in their minds the aha moment that perhaps you had when you had the idea in the first place.
You can also help your audience for your idea move off whatever they're stuck on by recategorizing. You have a great story in the book about a guy named Brian Delaney, who's a U.S. naval officer who just happens to be paralyzed.
Yes, he happens to be paralyzed and he's on active duty. So paralyzed and on active duty are not two things you typically see, because I think there's a policy where if somebody is paralyzed or disabled, they're no longer, they're honorably discharged from their position. And so the question is, how did this person keep his job? And so the story was, Brian tells is of his superior. First of all, Brian is well-loved and extremely good at his job. And his leader, his superior, went into his leader's superior officers and said, look, do you understand how strong this guy is? Now, remember, what we assume about somebody who's disabled is perhaps they're not strong enough physically to do the work. So what his leader did was recategorize strength. He said, this guy flatlined three times and survived. Think of how strong, think of the mental strength this person needed to have to survive. And that pitch of recategorizing something that might be seen as a weakness into a strength meant that his superior officers were like, you know what, you're right, let's keep him on. And he's still there as an administrative staff.
We have an email from Don who asks, could it be that those individuals who have invested the most in training and education, people like doctors, are the most resistant to creativity and change, even when intellectually they understand this trap exists?
Oh, it's... Yes, I think expertise, I think this recognition of new ideas is a new skill. And I think that we haven't thought of it that way, because we've thought that you do need expertise to help you recognize something. I think Thomas Fogarty, again, I'll go back to him, because he has this example of the statement, you know, the bigger the incision, the bigger the surgeon, or the bigger the surgeon, the bigger the incision, because it was thought at the time that surgeons, you know, it's like a like a hammer who wants a nail. They have a job to do, and that's what they're supposed to do. And that's what their expertise is in. And something that challenges that means retraining. You lose your expertise. You're no longer seen as expert. It challenges your very identity. You feel that uncertainty, like, now I really don't know how to evaluate something, if it's even though I'm the expert. So expertise makes it very hard for people to see value in the new. And I think part of what could help is if people could have some training, who are experts, about what it would mean. How do you use your expertise when you evaluate something that you're not as familiar with? And how different that is when you're evaluating something you're super familiar with, because right, they're different skill sets.
All right, let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. Syed is calling from Dallas. Hi, Syed.
Hi, Chris. Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity. And thank you, Jennifer, for spending your time. You have seemed to brought the San Diego weather with you. My quick question, how does having a growth mindset versus a fixed mindset play into choices we make when we choose our leaders?
Very interesting. We haven't looked necessarily at mindset when we choose our leaders, per se. But what we have found is that on average, people have stereotypes about creative types. The creative type in the research we find, yes, they're unconventional and they can be passionate and they can be competent and they can be smart. But we also have a stereotype that your creative type might be a little naive, might not be as efficient at getting things done, might be open to the point to which they're going in many different directions and are perhaps disorganized. And what we find is when somebody does not yet have leadership responsibility and they express a creative idea, that stereotype of being disorganized and potentially naive can actually harm their ability to gain a leadership position. Even though we also know that once people are in a leadership position and they have creative ideas, they don't necessarily have the same kind of downside, in part because they might be considered to be a different kind of creative type, like an innovator. You know, and innovators can execute and get stuff done. So we're not, my experience, though, and my thought is that, you know, this, I'll go back to the how best mindset, because that's how I think about it, that when we think of this how best mindset, and we see uncertainty around us, we don't like it, and we reject it. So what it means in part is we also rely on stereotypes, because when we can't, let's imagine you're trying to figure out if somebody's a leader. You don't have a whole lot of information about them. What information are you going to use? You're going to look to see if are they confident, do other people like them, and you're going to use your stereotypes. And those stereotypes, like creative people are naive, can be really detrimental to those people who are actually potentially great leaders, but also have the ability to create getting leadership positions.
Are there steps we can take to make ourselves and maybe our associates more tolerant of uncertainty?
Yes. Well, I think one of the most powerful findings that I have found is, you know, when people say they hate change or they don't like change or we dislike change, that is not true. We love change. We passionately adore change. And you know when we passionately adore creative change? When we're generating ideas. Huh. If you look at people in the course of generating ideas, when they have that aha moment, they express elation. They express this extreme joy and happiness. And that, so it's not the case that changing our minds is awful and painful, although it can also be, especially when you're on the receiving end of somebody trying to help you change your mind. And that can feel very bad. So where my work is coming from is to say, you know, if you want to help somebody change their mind and not just change their behavior, right? Because you can save more money or you can lose weight. And we all don't have to change our minds to do that. We just have to get out of our own way and, you know, overcome bad habits. But when it comes to creativity, you actually have to change your mind first before your behavior can follow suit. And so one of the things that can help you do that is not just listening, but experimentation. This idea of thinking of yourself like an inventor, having curiosity. So inventors understand that they don't know the answer. Otherwise, they wouldn't continue to invent. If they knew the answer, they would stop experimenting. And it's like adopting that way of seeing the world, like asking questions, challenging things that you see, data that you see, getting curious. It's in unleashing that in ourselves, as opposed to having to know the answer and having to be right and having to be correct and having to justify our decisions. Instead of taking that approach, which can be very good in situations where we know a lot about solutions, and when it comes to needing creativity, allowing room for our curiosity and to think more like inventors do. We care about the metrics, they do matter, but we also kind of want to learn more and have a drive to learn more.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Jennifer Mueller is my guest. We're talking about her book, Creative Change, Why We Resist It, How We Can Embrace It. Jennifer, how do you, as someone who had a creative idea and has probably had many over the course of your career, how do you avoid taking it personally when in the first round, your respected colleagues, your superiors said, that's not going to work?
Yeah, it's so hard. It's so hard. As a matter of fact, today I just got a reject and resubmit on a paper that I loved. And the reviewers, one of them said, this is the most amazing paper. I loved it. The second reviewer said, I love this paper. And the third reviewer said, this is the worst paper I've ever read.
And that's the one that sticks with you, right?
And that's the one that's, and of course the editor was like, huh, okay, how could it be both? I'm going to, you know, be really cautious about this paper. And it's so hard to not feel discouraged. It's so hard to not feel discouraged. But where I come from is to remind myself that people are really struggling with how to recognize value in the new. It's a new kind of skill. We're just starting to become aware of how sticky our beliefs are, and we live in these bubbles. And so that kind of helps me cope to say it's not me. Mm-hmm. It's that I need to understand what this person is thinking and where they're coming from, what their comparisons are and what they believe, so that I can help them understand the value of my idea. Because just talking about what I think isn't going to help, because I'm not connecting it to how they're thinking. And that's the challenge when you have creativity, is to figure out what your audience thinks. And every single member might have a different view. So it can be very difficult. But that, I view, is the challenge.
Are employers better off learning to spot incredibly creative potential hires, or learning not to get in the way of those hires?
Interesting question. I will say that many employers, when I talk to them and I ask them, they'll say, we don't have enough creativity. And I'll say, why do you think? And they'll say, because we hire all the worker bees, all the really creative people go into entrepreneurship. And I'll roll my eyes and I'll think, oh, no. Because I think that creativity is something, I don't think it's reserved to the creative genius. I don't think you either hire Einsteins or people who are not Einsteins. I think everybody has the capacity for creativity, and everybody has their own unique way of seeing the world, or at least can. So I see this as, the corporation, and this, by the way, this idea comes from Teresa Mobile, my advisor in grad school, and she has a book called The Progress Principle, which I would highly recommend your listeners check out. And her entire big idea was that organizations need to have an environment that encourages creativity. You can put an Einstein in an organization that kills creativity, and that Einstein won't do anything creative. Or you can put somebody with an average level of creativity into a corporation that encourages it, and creative and wonderful things can happen as a result.
Jennifer Mueller is Associate Professor of Management at the University of San Diego and author of Creative Change, Why We Resist It, How We Can Embrace It. Jennifer, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Subscribe to the podcast and find out about upcoming shows at think.kera.org. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.